Okay, so you were, well, let me look at these questions first. Okay, the last two questions that I ask everyone. How do you think the war experience and your experience in the service, how do you think that affected or changed you?
Well, it made me grow up.
Okay, all right. And when you look back at your experience now, and part of that growing up would be part of that, what do you think about maybe war in general, or the people who fight wars, the people who decide to have wars? Has that influenced your life, that experience?
Well, to a certain extent. You know, I didn't have any objections to going to into the service during World War II, because I thought that was a just. The Japanese attacked us in Pearl Harbor, and, you know, the fact that we immediately started gearing up to fight that war, I thought that was what we had to do.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone at that time got behind it, and even the women, you know, went to work. They worked in defense factories and took care of the home base, you know, and everything else, while the guys had to go to the service. And we got it done. But since then, with some of these wars that we've been in, you know, lately, that kind of bothers me, because I think we're getting involved with doing things that we really ought to stay out of.
It's changed a great deal, hasn't it,
right.
The world?
And I don't think they're just, for example, the war in Iraq, the majority of people are not in favor of that.
Right.
And the way we got into it was kind of manipulated.
Okay, then I want to go back to the Korean, and you didn't go, and you were farming sugar beets, and that was around Scott City.
Right.
And then you had, that's what you did from then on.
No.
No.
No. I farmed for 25 years, and finally my engineering work got me into another business.
Well, I was going to ask you if you ever used that. Okay, please tell me about that.
Well, in the 1960s, I was selected to be a member of the board of Wheatland Electric.
Okay.
Which was a rural electric cooperative.
Right.
And so I was only on that board a couple of years until the manager that was there got cancer, and he was involved in treating that for a year or so, and then he passed away. And the board at that time, after I'd been on it a while, realized that I had had some training. In fact, part of my training in college was in power plant testing, testing of equipment, and design of power plant equipment. And so they says, why don't you just fill in as the interim manager until we can find somebody to take his place? Well, I ended up being the manager for 18 years.
Okay.
And so that's when I started using my engineering studies, you know, a little bit. It was more in electrical engineering than it was in mechanical, but still the two are, you know, they're involved in a lot of things.
Right, and you had an engineering kind of mind, evidently.
Right. So I was there, and I was the general manager of Wheatland for 18 years, and I was also on the board of Sunflower Electric, and was involved in the building of Holcomb One out here. I was and also the largest gas-fired generating plant in the west side of Garden City. We built those two plants while I was general manager.
Oh, well, that's a whole nother story then.
Yeah.
Is Wheatland based here in
Main office is in Scott City.
Oh, so you just stayed up there.
Right.
Okay, I guess I didn't realize that.
Yeah, the main, we have office here. Wheatland has an office in Garden City, too, but the home office is Scott City, and always has been.
And so you then didn't farm at all?
I finally got completely out of the farming business.
Could you talk a little bit about farming sugar beets?
Well, there used to be a lot of sugar beets growing in western Kansas, and they're not anymore. But when I started farming in Scott County, I was on a little irrigated farm south of Scott City, and at that time, my father-in-law was raising sugar beets, and so that's what I started irrigating and raising, you know, crops that you could irrigate.
Okay, and what were the sugar beets then used for?
Well, to make sugar.
Like at Holly, Colorado?
Right, okay. Right. Used to be a sugar company in Garden City called the Garden City Company.
Okay.
And part of the year that I had the 300 acres of sugar beets, all those beets came to Garden City to be processed.
All right, then I'm going to ask some silly questions. How do you plant? Do you have a start of the beet plant that you put in the ground, or it's not seed?
Yes, it's seed.
Oh, it is?
Yes.
Oh. Where does the seed come from? Out of the beet somehow?
Yeah. The beets will make a seed if they let them go to seed.
Okay.
And little old beet seed is, well, you've planted beets in the garden, red beets. It's a seed similar to that.
Okay.
And it's planted in rows about 20, 22 inches apart, usually.
With a drill, or?
We had a beet planter.
Okay.
And then you plant them pretty thick. And the thing that kind of caused the farmers to go away from raising sugar beets in this part of the country was the fact that it took a lot of hand labor. Because you'd plant them in rows pretty thick, and then you'd hire the laborers, field laborers, who were mostly, they would come out of Mexico, and a lot of them, some of them were local, but they would come in groups, and they would go down those rows, and they would hand, with a little short-handled hoe, they would hand and thin those beets to where you had one plant about every 6 or 8 inches apart.
Okay.
They'd leave that, and they'd take all the rest of it out. Then you had to meticulously water those fields and cultivate them, and then about once or twice during the season, as those beets were growing and developing, you had to hire the laborers to come back in and hoe weeds. Then when the beets were ready to harvest in the fall, usually about October, November, they would, sugar beet, some of them be that big around, you know, and that long. You would come in there with a machine called a beet puller.
Okay.
And it'd go down those rows, and it'd raise those beets up out of the ground, loosen the ground and raise them up. Then these laborers would go in the field, and they would pick all those up and put them in a ditch. You put a ditch out about every 6 rows. And then you'd throw all those 6 rows of beets in that one furrow.
Okay.
And then they would, as they put them in there, they'd top the tops off. So the beets were laying in that furrow, and then they'd have a loader that'd come along, load them onto trucks, and haul them to the beet dump.
Okay. And they had to be irrigated.
They had to be irrigated several times, usually 5 or 6 times in a year.
And how many acres did you say?
300.
That's a lot of sugar beets.
That's a lot of sugar beets.
When the laborers came in, where did they stay, and how did they?
We had houses. They weren't very elaborate, but they were bunk houses, and the family, the Mexican families, would come in, and the women would. You know, do the cooking and feed the, usually in a group to do the hoeing, we'd have 20 or 25 in a group.
Okay, but just the men worked in the field?
Well, sometimes the women hoed too.
Okay, and I guess they would have children.
Right.
Okay.
Whole families would come in.
And how did you contact someone to get them to come, or did they just come?
Well, the contract, the beets that I raised that year were contracted to Garden City Company. And in the contract, they would provide the field workers to come in, and they move from field to field. You know, they'd
right.
They would take they wouldn't always stay at your place. They'd only stay long enough to do it. But they were moving around through the area, all the farmers that had sugar beets mm-hmm. taking care
that
of.
That would seem to be a very hard job,
and
what they did.
It was.
Mm-hmm.
It was.
Mm-hmm. Was it a profitable crop?
Sometimes it was real profitable, and sometimes it wasn't,
yeah.
depending on the seasons.
Mm-hmm.
Sugar content of the beet can vary.
Mm-hmm.
The final price that you received from the sugar company was after the beets were processed and made into sugar.
Mm-hmm.
Then the farmers would get their final payment. They would get payments progressively as those were being processed,
okay.
but you didn't get your final payment until they knew exactly how much sugar they were going to get.
Mm-hmm. And how many years did you grow sugar beets?
Well, it became such a hassle to keep up with it was very expensive to have all this hand labor.
Mm-hmm.
Now they did develop equipment which eliminated some of it, but still beet farming, you know, I think we finally quit and started raising crops like corn and alfalfa and milo. We didn't raise beets until, this was in 1950,
mm-hmm.
raised beets for 5 or 6 years, and then we gradually moved into corn and milo and cattle feeding.
Mm-hmm. And you just learned on your own how to raise beets?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Right. Yeah, you learn from experience.
Okay. All right, is there anything else that you think would be valuable to people who eventually we'll be using these tapes as research? Anything about the war or,
Do you want to hear an interesting thing?
Uh-huh.
I've told, this is an amazing thing that happened. And I didn't find out about it until just a year ago from
okay.
now.
Okay.
You ask if I kept in contact with these guys.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when I was in the band, of course, we had 14 or 15 guys that lived and and stayed together for a year.
Mm-hmm.
And they were from all over. This one Jewish kid, a little younger than I was, played a saxophone, a clarinet in the band. He and I played ping pong all the time for relaxation. I got to thinking about him.
Mm-hmm.
Wonder what ever happened, because we hadn't exchanged letters or communications for 50, 60 years.
Yeah.
Gosh, I don't have time to even drink my coffee. So I have ever since I retired, I got a computer,
mm-hmm.
and I play around with that too much, my wife says. But I was online one day, and I thought about him, and I wondered, you reckon I could find him on this computer and on the internet some way? I knew his name, I knew about where he was located, and I knew approximately his age.
Mm-hmm.
So I got in and I put his name into the computer and the approximate location, and here came up 4 or 5 names.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at them, and one of them was, this guy, his name was Norman Barole.
Okay.
And the last I knew, he was someplace in Randolph, Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
So I put that in, and his age is about 81 years old, and clicked it, and here this one came up, not in Randolph, but it was in Sharon, Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
And it gave his telephone number and his address. So I just picked up, I says, that's got to be him. I picked up the telephone, called that number, and he answered on the other end, and I says, is this Norman Barole? He says, it sure is. I says, well, my name is Lewis Mitchell. Oh, he says, you were the tall, dark-headed guy that played bass in the band, weren't you? I says, that's me. And we talked for an hour.
Uh-huh.
And he got to telling me about different guys that he kind of kept in contact with. There was 4 or 5 that, you know, he knew something about.
Mm-hmm.
Several of them had passed away and were gone. But he says, you remember when towards the end of the war, we got pretty good, you know, and we were our our band was in demand all over West Germany to play. And we were called in to Heidelberg to play over the radio, Armed Force Radio Network. And he says, you remember when we played over that radio, that program on the radio? And I said, sure. He says, well, if you remember, we had to get a vocalist, because we didn't have a vocalist at the time. We had to get a vocalist, and they called in a guy from another outfit and to sing with us. And he came in, we practiced a while, and then we played this program over the radio, and they made records for each one of us of the program and gave us a copy, each one of us. And I brought those home with me. Well, he says, you remember anything about this guy? And I said, no, I hardly remember him at all. I know we did have a singer, but I didn't know much about him. Well, he says, at that time, he called himself Joe Barry, B-A-R-I. And he sang two or three numbers while we were playing this program. And they're on the records. I said, I remember that. Well, he says, a few years after I got back, he says, my wife and I were in a place for dinner, and it was a, they were having a program and a band, and he says, this band was playing, and he says, as soon as they, this guy got up to sing, he says, I knew that I'd seen that guy. He says, I'm pretty sure that he was the guy that sang with us over in Germany. So he says, I went up and made it a point to go up and visit with him. And he says, sure enough, that was him. And he remembered playing with our band or singing with our band and all that. But he didn't stay with our band. He just sang the, you know, for that one program. And then he went back to his outfit. But he says, who do you suppose that turned out to be? Says he doesn't go by Joe Barry anymore. He says his name is Tony Bennett.
Oh my heavens. That is an amazing
story.
So
Tony Bennett got his start with our little band in Germany.
That is your claim to fame. He's still going strong.
He's still going strong, and I couldn't believe it. But since then, I've got all the information I could find on the internet, and sure enough, it lists all this, you know, in his history, and he remembered, and they've stayed in pretty good, you know, they've been in contact with each other, because I think Tony Bennett's from that same area.
So he came home and changed his name and started on it.
How he got the name changed, his name, he was an Italian boy. His name was Antonio something Benedetto.
Oh, I see.
And he was had the opportunity to sing on a program where Bob Hope was there when he came back. When he came back, he used his GI Bill to go to music school and improve his singing, you know, and all that, and because that's what he was interested in doing. And Bob Hope says, young fella, you have a very promising opportunity ahead of you. But he says, I would suggest that you shorten your name. He says, why don't you call yourself Tony Bennett? And so that's where he switched from being Joe Barry, Antonio Benedetto, to Tony Bennett.
That is an amazing story. I'm glad that you thought of that to tell that, really.
Well, it just, you know, was mind-boggling to me. I just had no idea that.
And that's all because you put one name in the computer on the internet.
Right.
And got,
right.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
So have any more of those stories?
No.
Okay, I think that I've covered all of these, unless you have something else.
Well, it's been, I've enjoyed this.
Well, you've given a good interview.
I had no idea that, you know, they'd ever want it to do anything like this. And I wouldn't even, it's been almost a year since, what was her name?
Bernie McGuirk.
McGuirk.
Mm-hmm.
She called me,
yeah,
wanted to know that if I'd be interested in being interviewed. I says, well, yeah, fine, but then I didn't hear anymore,
mm-hmm,
for a year.
And you know, it's hard. It was hard. I mean, she was doing the scheduling, and then I had to come out from Wichita because I live in Wichita.
Oh,
so
you do.
Yeah, and this is right at the end of the grant, so yeah. I'm glad that we got you because you had wonderful information.
Yeah.
So, okay, I'm going to turn this off then.